One of the major objectives of the Megillah is to illustrate the approach to life, the lifestyle, so to speak, of the Rasha, the wicked person, which essentially means those who live in accordance with their instincts, with their emotions. And the tzaddik is the one who lives in accordance with knowledge and with truth. So the Megillah is depicting that, how they approach different situations, how they react to different situations. Now we've seen that Haman, for example, Haman is someone who is brought down, is doomed, so to speak, not necessarily by external forces. That's an important theme of the Megillah, that the ultimate outcome, that the wicked are defeated and that the righteous are successful, it's not depicting it because of the factor of external intervention. As you see, for example, in the case of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus, when the Jews leave, there you see that in accordance with the natural order, the fact that the Jews were righteous and the Egyptians were evil would not have been enough to save the Jews. Of course, the wickedness of the Egyptians contributes to their downfall. There's no question about that. That's always the case. But they were chasing after the Jews, and the Jews were in a hopeless situation, and they were saved because of a miracle. Of course, even there, you see that it was the stubbornness, the sheer emotionalism of the Egyptians that brought them to doom, because it was their decision to recklessly jump in to the Yamsuf, even though it was split and the Jews were able to go through. Still in all, they should have thought it over and tried to analyze this, what's going on over here, and not just assume that they're going to be safe. But whatever the case may be, the Jews were saved because of something external. In the Megillah, you see a different picture. You see the downfall of the Russia, of the wicked person, and you see the salvation of the tzaddik pretty much on the basis of the natural order. Of course, the element of providence is present in the Megillah, but it's not in the same blatant form. It's behind the scenes, so to speak. But in the forefront, you see it's the behavior of the main protagonists. So it's depicting the behavior of Mordechai, the behavior of Achashverosh, what Esther did, for example. So part of the study of the Megillah is really to study the contrasts and how different people react in situations of stress. In chapter 2, in the midst of the description of the arrangements for the beauty pageant that Achashverosh established in order to find a new wife, it introduces us to Mordechai and Esther. That's in 5. Ish Yehudi, there was a Jewish man who was in Shushan. His name was Mordechai, and so forth. Then it talks about the fact that he was exiled from Yerushalayim in the exile that took place with Yechoniah, king of Yehuda, who was exiled by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel. Now take a look at 7. Vahi omenes Hadassah, and he nursed Hadassah. That means he raised her, he took care of her when she was a baby. He Esther Bas Dodo. She's Esther, the daughter of his uncle, which would make her his cousin. Ki ein lo avayin, because she did not have a father or mother. Vanara yifas toar v'tovas mara. And the girl was very good-looking, beautiful. Uvimos avia v'ima. And when her father and mother died, l'kacha Mordechai lo levas. Mordechai took her as a daughter. That is to say, that he adopted her as a daughter. Right, then it goes on to describe what takes place in terms of Esther and the pageant. But if you study the pasuk carefully, you'll notice that there is a problem in the structure of the pasuk. The problem with this pasuk is that it's repetitive. It seems to be repetitive. It's making the same point twice. It opens up by saying that he nursed her, that is, he raised her when she was a baby, because she didn't have a father and mother. And then it says that she was beautiful, and then it repeats itself. It says that when her father and mother died, he took her as a daughter. But that's what it told us at the beginning, that he nursed her because she didn't have a father and mother. So it just seems to be repeating the same piece of information in the same pasuk. I want to suggest a possible interpretation. It's describing what took place at that time. This was a situation in which they were exiled. So it's possible to say, you know, in a time of exile, families are broken up. During the Holocaust, people are running away, people are escaping, so families couldn't always stay together. So there were separations. And sometimes they were reunited afterwards. It happened even a few years later that the children were able to rediscover their parents. Sometimes it wasn't the case. Sometimes either the children were killed or the parents were killed, and they weren't reunited. But it could be that it's describing a process, because this passage comes right after telling us about the exile, and that is that Vayomein Es Hadasa, that first they experienced the exile, and at that point in time she was separated. It doesn't say that the parents died. It says ki ein lo av va'em. She didn't have a father and mother. Didn't have a father and mother doesn't necessarily mean they had died. It just means that she'd been separated. And Mordechai was in charge of her, took care of her. Then it says uvamos avia v'ima, that after, so to speak, the dust had settled, because the situation is in a state of flux. When things calmed down and they were able to find out what had happened, then they discovered that her parents had died. Then he actually adopted her as a daughter and raised her. So that would fit the pasuk, that there were two stages. One stage where he was functioning to take care of her. That's Omein. He was taking care of her because there was nobody else to take care of her. But that's not the same as adopting someone as a daughter, a permanent commitment. Then they discovered that the parents had died, and then he adopted her as a daughter. So I think that would explain the pasuk and would show that it's not really repetition. The question, however, would be that why is it that important to be that specific? To give us such a specific account of the relationship between Mordechai and Esther. It then goes on at greater length. The Megillah makes us very aware of this relationship. It wasn't just that he adopted her, but he was a very significant mentor.
All right, man.
Then it tells us that Esther did not reveal who she was, her nation, her background, that she was Jewish, in fact. Why? Because Mordechai had commanded her not to tell. So now you have a new piece of information. That is the nature of the relationship, that he was a mentor and she listened to him. Then, of course, it tells you that every day Mordechai would make it a point to be in front of the courtyard of the place where the women stayed. Lodas Shalom Esther, to know how Esther was doing. Umayyasaba, what was being done. So you see that it's depicting a very a close relationship between them. The Megillah makes a very significant point out of the fact that Esther did not reveal who she was. That's obviously very important in the overall story, because it returns to this again. That is, after telling us that the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she brought forth a chen, a certain type of chen, and chesed in front out of him, that he's a certain type of an endearment, a certain type of charm. That's also a very significant idea. We'll return to that at a different time. What's the significance of the charm factor? It plays a very big role in the story. So then it says that he made this great party for all of his ministers and servants. Mishte Esther. The party in honor of Esther. And then it goes in verse 20, it repeats that point, that Esther did not reveal Molarta and Amma. Kasher tziva aleha Mordechai. As Mordechai had commanded. And Ma'amar Mordechai, Esther Osa. Esther would act in accordance with the instructions of Mordechai. Kasher Haisa bi'amna ita. Just as it was when she was a child. When she was a child and he was raising her as a parent, so of course that's natural. It's natural for the child to be obedient. But that's a different type of a phenomenon. You'll notice that very often. That many people, of course, when they were children, they listened to their parents. Then when they get older, they don't listen to their parents anymore. That's a completely different situation. Because now they have a mind of their own, and it could very well be that they don't agree with what their parents have to say. Now, that's perfectly acceptable. I'm not talking in terms of respect. One always has to show respect for one's parents. But that doesn't mean to say that you have to agree with their ideas about life and other things. So now the pasuk is saying that even when she became independent and she was mature and she was older, she would still follow the instruction, the ideas of Mordechai, just as she did when she was a child and he was raising her. The question, of course, arises that why does it have to repeat the fact that she wouldn't give out who she was in accordance with his instruction? That we already know from before. The Megillah has already mentioned that she did not reveal that according to his decision. Now it's repeating the same thing. The answer is that there were two different situations over here. In the first situation, she was in a completely new situation. This whole pageant, and she was noticed, and It was a situation in which she wouldn't really know how to handle herself, what to do, what not to do. So then it makes more sense to accept the advice of your mentors. But what happens very often is that once a person experiences a certain amount of independence and success, and she's chosen to be the queen, and it turns out, even though she was extremely modest and she didn't expect this to happen, but it turns out that all of a sudden you're the star, the superstar, and she's chosen, so then a person tends to feel much more confident about making their own decisions. You may not be that dependent anymore. It may go to your head, and you may question all your past relationships. This shows you that it did not go to her head, that the fact that she achieved all of this acclaim, something which would have an effect, a psychological effect on virtually anybody, it didn't go to her head at all. It shows a certain perfection, and it didn't interfere with her relationship to Mordechai. Her respect for Mordechai and his wisdom, his understanding, remained intact. But that's why it repeats it again, and it says, Kasher hoisa bi'amna ito, that's a different kind of thing. That even just like when she was young and dependent, and then it's natural for a person to listen to someone, an older person's, a wiser person's advice because of your situation, she had the same respect for him even when she was no longer in that situation, because it was based upon a genuine respect. for his greatness, for his wisdom, for his chachma. That's the point that the Megillah is making. Now, again, the question still arises, why is it so important? Why is that point that Esther was so completely trusting, had such great respect for what Mordechai said, why is that so significant? Now we're going to go ahead to chapter 4. This is after Haman has convinced the king to put into effect the plan to kill all the Jews, exterminate the Jews. And then it says the reaction of Mordechai, that Mordechai knew everything that had happened. He knew all the, he had all the information. And he tore his garments, and he put on sackcloth and ashes. Then he went out into the middle of the city, and he screamed a loud and bitter wail. That was his reaction. Of course, one can ask, what kind of a reaction is this? What's the purpose? How is this going to help the situation? Seems to be a completely emotional response. And a person's going around like a raving lunatic. And generally we say that you're supposed to be able to control your emotions and to put together a rational plan. Nevertheless, let's continue. Then it says he came up to the place of the gate of the king, because you couldn't go any further. You couldn't go within the Shaar HaMelech, the gate of the king, dressed up in sackcloth. So he went as far as he could go, given that he wasn't dressed properly to go any further. Then it tells us that the news about Mordechai's strange dress and his strange behavior came to Esther. They told Esther. Her servants told her. And she was extremely upset. She was distraught by this. And she sent clothing. It seems that she was distraught about the fact that he was going around like that. Didn't seem appropriate. So she sent clothing to remove the sackcloth. But he didn't refuse. Actually, he didn't accept. The low-key veil, he didn't accept. So you have a strange dialogue then that takes place. Then she appointed this individual, Hasach, some type of a spokesperson, to go to Mordechai and find out what was going on. L'das mazeh v'al mazeh. What is this? What kind of behavior is this? And what's the reason for it? So then Hasach goes to Mordechai, and Mordechai tells him everything that had happened and the apportioning of the money that Haman had mentioned to put aside all the money, not just the plan. It's one thing to have a plan, but it's quite another thing to have the budgeting. That's always a significant thing. You can have a lot of plans. But like in America, if Congress doesn't budget the money, it's not going to happen. Once the money is budgeted and the money is there, so then that's it. There's nothing going to stop it. To destroy the Jews. So then he shows a copy of the order that was sent out to all of the provinces to destroy the Jews, but essentially to show it to Esther. So he's giving Hasach the proof to show it to Esther and to tell her and to command her. Now he has a specific instruction for her to go to the king, to plead before him, and to request from him mercy. Because she's the only one in a position that could do anything, apparently. There was nothing else she could do. This is not a democracy, obviously. And what options did he have? There was just one option. That she was in a very significant position. She was the queen, and Ahasuerus loved her very much. And she's the only one that could turn to him. She had leverage. So he's instructing her to go before the king. Then it says that Hasach came and told Esther the words of Mordechai. Now what happens is a very strange dialogue. And the answer of Esther is in Pasuk Yud Aleph, that's 11, which essentially is a very polite kind of a refusal. Because she seems to have a very good reason. She's saying that what you're asking me to do, I can't do. Because everybody knows that whoever appears in the courtyard, the inner courtyard, of the king unannounced, so without exception, that person is liable to be killed. That's the law. Unless the king decides, for whatever reason, to stretch forth the golden scepter. That would be a sign that he accepts your presence and he's not going to kill you. But she says, I have not been called for 30 days. So therefore, she refuses. Right? That's something that has to be understood. Here we do see an exception to what we've learned before. In the past, we've learned that basically she listened to Mordechai. She followed the word of Mordechai, just like when she was a child. But this time, she disagrees with him. On the surface, it would seem that she has very good reason. Because basically what he was telling her to do, and apparently that's what he was telling her to do, is to just go before the king. And she's saying she can't do that because you could be killed. So what good will that do? Well, if that's the case, one would think that she's right. Perhaps Mordechai didn't know that when he issued the instruction. Let's say he wasn't aware of that law. But the truth of the matter is that he was aware of that law, as we'll soon find out. But on the surface, what she's saying seems to make sense. It seems to be logical. But look at the response of Mordechai. Mordechai gives him a very sharp rebuke. And he says, do not imagine in your soul that you'll be saved in the king's house from all of the Jews, that you alone will be saved. For if you will be silent at this point, then salvation will come to the Jews from a different place. But you and your father's house will be lost. And who knows, if not for just such a time, did you become the queen. He got La Malchus. You achieved this position. So, it's kind of cryptic, like, he's not really answering her question. He's talking on a different plane, and he's rebuking her pretty harshly. Sounds like he's accusing her of being more concerned about her own personal life than about the Jewish people, and not recognizing the significance that she should look at the situation from a completely different perspective, and that perhaps this is all a matter of the Hashkacha, the divine providence, and you should look at it from that perspective and what your role is from that perspective and not from your personal perspective. But it's strange because she seems to have made a good argument. And that is, for example, I think Rabbi Chaid explained many, many years ago that she wasn't saying that she's not going to help. It's impossible to imagine that anybody in a position, even people that are not as great as Esther, that have some concern for the Jews if they're in a position of authority and you're asking them to intercede to save Jewish life, it's hard to imagine that what kind of person would refuse to do that. So certainly Esther wasn't refusing to do whatever she could do. However, what was her point? Her point, when she said that whoever goes unannounced can be killed, was merely to say that it doesn't make sense to do it the way you're telling me to do it. You're telling me to go unannounced. But by doing that, I'm putting myself at risk. I haven't been called for 30 days. And she really doesn't know what the fact, perhaps that means she's not in favor anymore, if she hasn't been called in 30 days. Now what good will that do? So what was her alternative? What was she suggesting? The Megillah doesn't spell it out. But, and if I remember correctly, Rabbi Chait's explanation was that she was saying that she won't go about it this way, but it makes more sense to go about it through the natural channels. To, instead of just going suddenly, unannounced, why not take the steps, make the provisions to get a appointment? When she gets an appointment, so then she's removed the danger, and then she can go in a methodical way and then make her request. That's basically what you must say that she was saying, because you can't say that she was saying she's not going to intercede with the king at all. So therefore, let's assume that that's correct. That makes perfect sense. If that indeed is what her position was, that she wasn't refusing to help. She was just saying that your suggestion doesn't make sense. What am I going to gain? What if I'm killed? So nobody wins. So let me go about it differently. It makes sense to assume she'll be able to get an appointment. So it won't be today or tomorrow. Let's say it's a week from now. Now, if that is the case, then what is the argument of Mordechai? Mordechai doesn't back off. Mordechai doesn't even explain his position, but he proceeds to rebuke her and to question her motives. The Rav, Zichrono Livracha, was fond of explaining the behavior of Mordechai. He used to compare that Mordechai tore his clothing, put on sackcloth, put on ashes, and he went out into the middle of the city and just screamed a loud and bitter wail. It just became hysterical screaming. And he explained that there was the reason for that. That's exactly how the Jew has to behave in a situation like that. That you have to recognize when you're in a situation, when you're up against Amalek. He criticized the Jews, that during the Holocaust, the American Jews did in fact go about trying to protest and get the United States government to do more, to help out, and so on and so forth. But by and large, essentially, it was a complete failure. And he said the reason is because they went about it through normal channels. They were respectful, they made appointments, they wrote letters, and so on and so forth. But they didn't act like Mordechai. There are certain situations where you have to recognize the nature of the tragedy, the calamity, and you just have to throw out completely the whole idea of business as usual. What impresses people is not the fact that you're making a protest. It's not the fact that you've collected petitions. There's two different ways of acting, two different kinds of situations. Now, in a situation, ordinary situations, you want to bring about certain changes and so on and so forth, so there's procedures. You go by the normal procedures. But then there are situations where you can't go by the normal procedures, because you have to recognize that there's a tremendous amount of resistance within the bureaucracy, so to speak. And the idea at that point in time of the American government intervening in a manner that would save Jews was a very difficult thing to achieve. There was a tremendous amount of resistance. So in that situation, when you're acting like that, it's not the words that you're saying. It's you got to convince them that on this matter you're prepared to put your life on the line. You're prepared to throw off everything, all of your dignity, all of your accomplishments, all of your positions, and you tear your garments, that this is something that I can't live with, and you're in a state virtually of hysteria. You've got to convince them of that. It's only when they see that the extent of your commitment that might bring forth a response. And in certain individual cases, I can't go into right now, there were those people that did adopt this approach and it did have an effect. But the mere fact that you're choosing to go about it through normal channels, you're making appointments, and so on and so forth, that itself shows that, okay, you can wait, that it's important to me, but the very fact that I'm respecting the system, I'm going through the bureaucracy, that itself says something. It means to say that it's not the foremost thing on my mind. That I'm going, and you see that sometimes a person will go on a hunger strike. And that's effective. They go on a hunger strike until something is done. Then you see that the authorities react for a number of reasons. But the mere fact that you're so committed to this, that you're willing to die for this, that must come through. And the Rav said that this is what the American Jews failed to do, so to speak. They didn't tear their clothing. They went on pretty much with business as usual. And they didn't go in the middle. He said they should have gone in the middle of the street and just screamed aloud and bit a whale. That was the point of Mordechai. And that's precisely the point that he was telling Esther. No, you have to go now. He knew the rule. He knew the law. that by doing so, she risked being killed. But he said, precisely that's the point. The fact that you go about this through normal channels, you ask for an appointment, that's going to doom the entire effort. But it's precisely the idea that you don't care about that and you're prepared to put your life on the line, that this is so important that you're going to act in a completely uncharacteristic way with full knowledge that he may kill you, that will get his attention. And that's the most important factor in the entire process. That's why he didn't accept her answer. And to the contrary, he rebuked her and he told her, look within yourself. And perhaps it's because of certain emotions that you have. The reason why you're taking your position is not because this position doesn't make sense. It's possibly because you have certain defects. So he spoke to her in a very, very harsh kind of a way. Very, very accusatory. And of course, the question arises, why? Why did he speak this way? You don't speak this way to people. Why didn't he explain his position? Assuming that this is correct, as I've just elucidated it. He could have just explained why he believes that she shouldn't go that way, but she should go this way. That would have been much more respectful. Why did he choose to do it this way? There are times when you have to argue with substance. There are times when it's really not an issue of substance. It's something very, very deep. It's much deeper. Where the point is clear, you see what's going on now, for example, this whole argument in the United Nations, the United States on one side and France on the other side. And in the press conference last week, so when Bush was making his case about how clear it was and convincing with all the intelligence that they had in terms of Iraq, that Iraq did have weapons of mass destruction, that they were in violation. So one of the questions that kept coming up again and again, and he just didn't answer it. The question was, well, if that's the case, and you say you've shared this information with France and Germany, and they know what you know, so why do you think that they have a completely different picture and they completely disagree with you? Now, he never answered that question as to why. He just kept repeating his basic ideas, basic theme. Then afterwards, on the analysis, the talk show's analysis, so one of the hosts was very incisive, very sharp. This is O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Factor. And his guest was Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House. And he was asking him, why didn't he answer that question? Why didn't he explain the reasons why the French, even though the facts are there, have a completely different picture? And the answer that Newt Gingrich gave him was something you could learn from, was interesting. And he said that when he was Speaker of the House, he would have answered that kind of question, and it would have been a mistake. Because basically, in order to answer that question, what do you have to do? You have to get into their motives. So whatever you say, pretty much, is going to be negative, in one way or another, no matter how you put it. If you want to indicate that it's because they're not really interested in the truth, they have certain motives, they have certain interests, ulterior motives, that's basically what you're going to have to say. You're going to have to explain that for one reason or another, no matter how polite you put it, it's going to be negative. That they have to protect their interests, or perhaps they have some, you're going to have to suggest something about them. And so what do you gain politically? That's going to be the headline the next day. Bush accuses the French of such and such. So therefore, he was saying it was extremely wise of Bush not to answer that question. Because his job is not to be a psychologist or an analyst. His job is to present the case. And it's not his business to go into the psychological motives of others. So you see that in general, in today's world, that's the way it is. That very often people get locked up into debates. And you know pretty much that the other side has an emotional reason. Maybe they don't like Bush, maybe they like this one, whatever the case is. But it's not acceptable. It's not considered polite. You have to just stick to your case and win the case on the merits, but you can't start psychoanalyzing somebody else. But you see that in this situation, Mordechai operated differently. That here, essentially, what he was saying is that the problem is not the idea. This idea makes sense. Of course, you can argue up and back. You can argue that the other way is better, because this way there's no risk and you have an appointment and so forth. You can argue it up and back. But he held that the main problem over here is that there's some personal reluctance within Esther. And therefore, he chose an approach which, generally speaking, is going to be very, very unpopular. People don't like to be psychoanalyzed. And when you do this with a friend, generally speaking, get into a discussion this and that, and instead of arguing on substance, you start attacking that person and saying, oh, because you have certain emotions or you have certain fears. So people don't like to hear that. And they'll say, forget about that. Let's talk about substance. Let's not get into my emotions. But he operated differently over here. He chose a course which is very, very unpopular. And he was very unstinting. It was really a rebuke. Don't imagine that you'll be saved. Kind of accusing her, indirectly, that perhaps you may be concerned about saving your own life and putting your own life above that of the people. But what was her response? What was the response of Esther? The response is very, very interesting and perhaps surprising. Vatomer Esther l'hashiv al Mordechai. Esther responds to Mordechai, go and gather all of the Jews who are to be found in Shushan and fast over me and don't eat and don't drink for 3 days. Also I and my maidens will fast as well. And thus shall I come before the king, asher lo chadas, contrary to the law, I'm going to break the law and risk my life. V'chasher avadati, avadati. And if I'm supposed to die, if that's what it is, I'm prepared to die. So you see that that was the whole issue. She accepted that. She heard what he said. She recognized it. She was makabel. She accepted it. And she redirected herself. And she acted in accordance with the instruction of Mordechai, which indeed was what was required. So the point that I'm trying to make is that the entire nes, the entire miracle of the Megillah, is really connected to what the pasuk is pointing out. That pasuk of Vayihi Omenes Hadassah is not just there for description, that he nursed Hadassah, that he adopted her, that he raised her, that he advised her, and she listened to him, is a very significant factor, because the entire miracle was dependent upon that. Without that factor, one could argue that she wouldn't have accepted this. A person is not going to accept this type of a critique just from anybody. In order to accept this, you must be in a position where you're dealing with someone who you trust completely. You trust them in terms of their insight, in terms of their intelligence, because you're putting your life on the line. And in terms of their integrity, that they don't have any personal motivation. It's very difficult to accept rebuke. But the acceptance of rebuke is vital. Is vital. A person can only achieve perfection if they're fortunate enough to have someone, and not everybody has this kind of a relationship, to have a relationship with someone who has the capacity to rebuke you. And that is based upon two factors. One, that the person, you respect their chachma, you respect their intelligence. And secondly, you respect their integrity. That they're not doing it for anything personal, but that they have your best interests at heart. That is a result of the close relationship that existed between Mordechai and Esther. And that's, I believe, why the Megillah is pointing that out. That it began when he actually nursed her, and then he adopted her as a daughter. And then he advised her, even when she was young. And then when the pageant came, he still advised her. And then after she was chosen to be the queen, he was still in the courtyard, still retained contact. That closeness. So at one point in time, she disagreed with him. And that was because of a certain type of an emotion it's understandable. Anybody could have that. But fortunate is the person that has a relationship. Not every Mordechai, so to speak, has an Esther. And not every Esther has a Mordechai. The existence of such a relationship, the Megillah is pointing this out, the existence of such a relationship is a vital aspect in a person's perfection. Of course, Kinei Lecha Chaver, Kinei Lecha Rav, these ideas are part of the Masorah. But again, it's not something that everybody has. It's something which has to be developed. On two sides, from both sides, obviously there's an obligation upon whoever it is, the Rebbe, the teacher, whatever the case, the parent, to act in such a manner. But there's also an obligation upon the child or the student, whoever it is. And by the way, it could be the Rebbe in one case, could be the student in a different case. Because in one relationship, you could be the teacher and the advisor. But then you could be in a situation where you yourself are blind and you need advice from somebody else. And you're the one who is the Esther and you need the Mordechai. But that idea is a very, very significant idea. That part of the derech of the tzaddik is that the person welcomes rebuke, wants rebuke. But of course, it's not enough to want it. Has a relationship with an individual who's capable of giving the correct insight, the correct rebuke. So even if you want rebuke, you may find yourself in a situation where you don't have access. Interestingly enough, you have, for example, in the case of David, that David sinned. But David had an Asan HaNavi. He was a prophet. And it seems simplistic to us. We just read this, oh yeah, Nasan came. Nasan gave him the analogy, and then he pointed out to him. But then he pointed out to him, Atoish, that's really you. And David was able to see clearly the significance of the sin that he had committed and the fact that he had covered it up. But then when Nasan pointed it out to him, he was macabre, accepted it. That's because he had a relationship with Nasan HaNavi. He could have denied. The person can always deny. You see, even when God confronted Adam, he denied, or he blamed the woman. The person can always do that. Now, that's a very significant theme. If you take a look, contrast this particular point with the behavior of the Russia in a similar situation. The salvation of the Jews had a lot to do with this phenomenon, with this relationship, with the ability to accept tochacha, rebuke. The downfall of the Russia was very much connected to the fact that the Russia doesn't have a true friend, that the Russia does not live in the world of rebuke. And where do you see that? You see that in the reaction of Haman. We discussed this a few weeks ago, that the effect of being invited to the party, and in his mind, he was in the world of illusion at that. He had no idea what that party was leading to. And you see that once the emotions of the Russia are engaged, he loses all rationality. And that's exactly part of the plan of Esther. Her plan was not to deal directly and make a direct appeal to Ahasuerus. She had this whole plan. The essence of the plan was, first of all, to take them off their god, to put both of them in a state of extreme emotion. As far as Haman is concerned, you have to realize that Haman was a very dangerous individual. But the entire danger of Haman is only when he's using his mind. And he's not a thinker that's in the world of ideas, per se. He's only using his mind when the impulses, when the emotions are forcing him to. So when you put him in a different emotional state, then to the contrary, then he's going to be governed by emotion and he's not going to be using his mind at all. And the same is true with Ahasuerus. That's why he couldn't sleep that night. She created a situation in which he'd now come under the sway of certain very powerful emotions and actually paralyze him in terms of, well, she did activate the mind. The truth of the matter is that with Ahasuerus, she activated the mind. That was her goal, but to activate the mind in a certain direction, to cause him to start looking at the whole relationship with Haman in a much more critical kind of a way, and indeed that's what happens. So she was manipulating his mind. It's more correct to say that she was manipulating his mind through the stimulation of very, very powerful emotions. And the same is true with regard to Haman, to put him in an emotional state in which he'd be thrown completely off of his game. So the first reaction was that he was extremely excited, extreme happiness. And you see, that's the methodology of the Russia. Because in truth, why was he so happy all of a sudden? He had no idea what was going on. Ahasuerus wasn't happy about the party. Well, the way she designed it, it was designed so that he should become suspicious. And on the surface, it did look as though it was some kind of an honor with regard to Haman. But Haman should have been skeptical. He should have been skeptical. You don't jump to celebration so quickly, even though it looks good. That's another thing you learn about the Russia. His emotions impel him to start celebrating before the time has come. Because as soon as it looks like it's falling out the way he wants to, his ego takes over. But even then, he might have been a little bit happy. It looks pretty good. But do you know? Do you know why she's inviting you? It's strange. It's strange for Ahasuerus. It's strange for you. Why are you so happy about this? Why? Because it's going your way on an emotional level. But then we saw that as soon as he walked out, he was completely enraged by the sight of Mordechai. And we said, because when the emotion is in that state of satisfaction, he can't control it anymore, and now the anger was greater than it was originally. So what does he do over there? Let's pick it up with the behavior of Haman. As soon as he sees Mordechai, he's totally devastated. He's crippled. He can't function. This is why he's a pack. He just had barely to control himself to get himself back to his house. So what does he do? He sends for his Ohavav, for his friends, and his wife Zeresh. So he too is in search of advice. So you have a similar situation. And then he tells them all of his greatness. He's trying to resuscitate himself. He's pleading with them, his great wealth, his great children, and the promotion, all of his success, how the king had promoted him above all of the ministers and servants of the king. He's trying to pump himself up. And then he says that Esther didn't invite anybody to the party except me. And also tomorrow I'm invited with the king. Then he says something very, very fascinating. And all this is not worth anything to me. Any time that I see Mordechai, the Jew, sitting in the gate of the king. That's what he says. That's an amazing insight, but it's not an insight which he was able to exploit in any kind of a useful way. It's a recognition. What would somebody have told him in that situation? How is it possible? All these achievements, everything, your wealth, tremendous wealth, children, position, promotion, success, everything that a person could possibly want. You're telling me it's nothing? Just because you see one person that won't show you respect? Now, a logical person would tell him that, well, what are your values? Doesn't make any sense. It's crazy. If that's the case, what you need to do is to introspect, to look inward and to find out why is that the case. Well, it could be that everything that you're pursuing is really a fantasy. Because if these things were really good and they made you happy and they were worthwhile, then true, the fact that Mordechai wouldn't bow down, that would be a source of pain, but you can't say that that's going to make everything else worthless. That just doesn't make any sense. Because then you have a lot of good things in your life, and you have one bad thing. But the fact you have one bad thing doesn't wipe everything else out. Wouldn't that mean that perhaps all these other things are just illusions? You're chasing after illusions, and you're attempting to resuscitate yourself because of some insecurity, perhaps, some need to glorify your ego, and all these things are just illusions. And then when you see the truth, when you see a Mordechai who represents some kind of reality, because that's what it is, he's a reality principle, and when you see him, you can't deny the reality that you're really nothing. That would have been some pretty good advice. But what was the advice that they gave him? They didn't tell him to introspect. No, to the contrary. See, why? Because the Russia doesn't have friends. A true friend is one who's out for your own best interests. The friends of the Russia are imaginary friends. What they seek to do is to avoid him, to shield him from the truth, because they imagine if they were to say anything that was critical, he wouldn't be their friend anymore. And a lot of people do that, by the way, not just in these kinds of situations. You can look into your own relationships. That very often you refrain from saying something negative to someone, or criticizing, or rebuke him. And to the contrary, you say positive things. Because that feeling is that this person will like me if I praise him. If I criticize him, the person will dislike me. Over here, I think that these were Ohavav. Who did he call? His friends. Meaning to say, those who were there to pat him on the back and to tell him the things he wanted to hear, but not the things that he needed to know. They led him to his destruction because the advice that they gave him was one, okay, this is the way that Russia operates. You've got a problem. It's Mordechai. But Mordechai is not really the problem. The problem is something within. You're taking something which is not a problem. Mordechai is not the real problem. And you're making it into a real problem, and you're treating it as though it was a real reality, that if you got rid of him, you'd be okay. That's the method of the Russia. So that's what they said. Oh, you can't deal with him, so get rid of him. We have a great idea. Prepare a tree. And in the morning, you'll go to the king and tell him to hang Mordechai. And then you'll go to the second party, Sameach, because the whole problem was, this is the greatest time of my life, this is the greatest event, and I can't enjoy it, because I have to confront Mordechai. Oh, so get rid of him. Now, that was terrible, terrible advice. Because the whole success of Mordechai in achieving his objectives, insofar as the king is concerned, was because he was able to masquerade them. He was able to make it appear as though the destruction of the Jews was not for personal purposes, was purely for the sake of the benefit of the king, and that's why he offered to pay the money, and the Jews were disloyal, and they'd be harmful to the state. He had to hide the personal motive, and indeed, the unraveling, the whole strategy, the objective of Esther's strategy, was to show the opposite, that Haman is absolutely selfish and he's utilizing the king and the kingship and everything purely for his own purposes. And to the contrary, the Jews are the ones who are loyal to you. That was the objective. But what he didn't even wait till the morning. They said to wait till the morning. He could not even wait till the morning. And then he starts to act in a completely foolish manner. He's not acting intelligently now. He goes to the king in the middle of the night with this idea to hang Mordechai, but he has no idea what's going on. Then it shifts, the scene shifts to Ahasuerus, and he couldn't sleep that night. We know why he couldn't sleep that night. And he's starting already to read the records. He's suspicious. And then he reads about the fact that there was a plot, and Mordechai the Jew reported it, but he wasn't rewarded for this. And then he suddenly appears with his idea to tell the king to hang Mordechai. You see how stupid this is. What happens, in point of fact, is he doesn't get a chance to even tell him that, because then he's confronted by the king, and the king now is a completely different type of a king. Beforehand, he was completely passive because he trusted Haman, but the party of Esther and the strange request that the only person there should be Haman, and her unwillingness to reveal had aroused a certain trend of thought. And now he was emotionally distancing himself and turning against Haman. And then Haman experiences a terrible, terrible disaster, which would not have occurred to him. All these things are significant, because it's step by step by step, until the king achieves such a hostile state of mind against Haman, that when Esther finally did say, and she did reveal that according to the plan, she too would be killed, then Ahasuerus was filled with rage. So you see that the objective of Esther was not to present the cold facts and the arguments in a rational way that would not have any effect on Ahasuerus. She had to manipulate him until emotionally he was predisposed towards hearing the ideas which were true, but these ideas have to be in line with his emotions, to the extent that he was filled with rage and he had to leave the room. But you see that the Russia contributed to his own downfall. Had he not seen Mordechai as he left the party, had he not been in that state of absolute rage, but more significantly, had he not been duped by pseudo friends, people who aren't true friends, they're called sycophants. They're just there to praise you and pat you on the back and giving the most terrible advice that actually propelled him further to destruction, because that brought him immediately into the sights of the king at a moment when the king was upset that Mordechai hadn't been rewarded, and then he instructed Haman to do that. That was significant, a very significant step in the downfall of Haman. You see that a significant element in the life of the Russia is that the Russia doesn't have any friends. The tzaddik is the only one who has friends, because a true friend is someone who's concerned about you from the standpoint of your soul, your best interests, and is not interested in his own selfish desire to have you feel good about him. He's willing to sacrifice that for your interests, to point out the actual truth, because the only thing that can help you is the truth. And a person that's incapable of accepting and dealing with rebuke cannot grow. And the Russia, to the contrary, does not want rebuke, hates rebuke. As Mishlei makes this point many, many times, hates rebuke. And in the end, that's a very significant element in his downfall. The Russia must be destroyed as a natural result of the very foundation. Derech Rishayim Toved. The way of the Russia is destruction. It has to lead to destruction. It can only operate successfully in limited situations. But there'll always be situations which demand a tremendous reassessment of where you're going. And you can see time and time again, in the case of the history of Hitler, Yimach Shemo, you can see many, many cases. He was successful at first because he took the world by surprise. And he gained tremendous advantages because of the stupidity of the allies and appeasement, whatever the case was. But finally, when they actually were fighting, and he found himself in situations which went contrary to what his intuition, had told him that this is the right thing to do. For example, in the campaigns against Russia and so on and so forth, he never ever was able to retract and to readjust. Because he couldn't face the fact that his intuition could possibly be wrong. And there was nobody in his entire circle that was able to confront him and to sit down with him and to rebuke him. Well, we're of course very happy about that. But I'm just pointing it out that that's part of the Derech Rishayim, that the Russia does not have any access towards tshuva, does not have any access towards repentance, towards rebuke, towards change, and therefore he's completely at the mercy of the inherent limitations that exist within everybody. Everybody is inherently limited, but the egomania of the Russia tells him that he's beyond the restraints of human limitations, and that he deifies his own intuition, his own emotions, and believes that if he can only implement his own vision, then he can achieve automatic success. That's the megalomania of the Russia. And that is, in and of itself, what leads to his destruction.